Chapter 13. About 3 o'clock, speaking in modern style, the program was concluded except the chariot race. The editor, wisely considerate of the comfort of the people, chose that time for a recess. At once the vomitoria were thrown open, and all who could hastened to the portico outside, where the restaurateurs had their quarters. Those who remained yawned, talked, gossiped, counted their tablets, and, all distinctions else forgotten, merged into but 2 classes, the winners, who were happy, and the losers, who were grum and captious. Now, however, a 3rd class of spectators, composed of citizens who desired only to witness the chariot race, availed themselves of the recess to come in and take their reserved seats. By so doing, they thought to attract the least attention and give the least offense. Among these were Simonides and his party, whose places were in the vicinity of the main entrance on the north side, opposite the consul. As the 4 stout servants carried the merchant in his chair up the aisle, curiosity was much excited. Presently someone called his name. Those about caught it and passed it on along the benches to the west. And there was hurried climbing on seats to get sight of the man about whom common report had coined and put in circulation a romance so mixed of good fortune and bad that the like had never been known or heard of before. Ilderim was also recognized and warmly greeted. But nobody knew Balthazar or the 2 women who followed him, closely veiled. The people made way for the party respectfully, and the ushers seated them in easy speaking distance of each other down by the balustrade overlooking the arena. In providence of comfort, they sat upon cushions and had stools for footrests. The women were Iris and Esther. Upon being seated, the latter cast a frightened look over the circus and drew the veil closer about her face, while the Egyptian, letting her veil fall upon her shoulders, gave herself to view, and gazed at the scene with the seeming unconsciousness of being stared at, which, in a woman, is usually the result of long social habitude. The newcomers generally were yet making their first examination of the great spectacle, beginning with the consul and his attendants, when some workmen ran in and commenced to stretch a chalked rope across the arena from balcony to balcony in front of the pillars of the 1st goal. About the same time, also, 6 men came in through the Porta Pompei and took post, 1 in front of each occupied stall, whereat there was a prolonged hum of voices in every quarter. "See, see! The green goes to number 4 on the right. The Athenian is there.
And Messala, yes, he is in number 2.
The Corinthian!
Watch the white! See, he crosses over and stops. Number 1 it is. Number 1 on the left.
No, the black stops there, and the white at number 2.
So it is!
These gatekeepers, it should be understood, were dressed in tunics colored like those of the competing charioteers, so, when they took their stations, everybody knew the particular stall in which his favorite was that moment waiting.
"Did you ever see Messala?"
the Egyptian asked Esther. The Jewess shuddered as she answered no. If not her father's enemy, the Roman was Ben-Hur's.
"He is beautiful as Apollo."
As Iris spoke, her large eyes brightened and she shook her jeweled fan. Esther looked at her with the thought,
"Is he, then, so much handsomer than Ben-Hur?"
Next moment she heard Ilderim say to her father,
"Yes, his stall is number 2 on the left of the Porta Pompei."
And, thinking it was of Ben-Hur he spoke, her eyes turned that way. Taking but the briefest glance at the wattled face of the gate, she drew the veil close and muttered a little prayer. Presently, Sanballat came to the party.
"I am just from the stalls, O Sheik," he said, bowing gravely to Ilderim, who began combing his beard, while his eyes glittered with eager inquiry. "The horses are in perfect condition."
Ilderim replied simply,
"If they are beaten, I pray it be by some other than Messala."
Turning then to Simonides, Sanballat drew out a tablet, saying,
"I bring you also something of interest. I reported, you will remember, the wager concluded with Messala last night, and stated that I left another which, if taken, was to be delivered to me in writing today before the race began. Here it is. Simonides took the tablet and read the memorandum carefully. Yes, he said. Their emissary came to ask me if you had so much money with me. Keep the tablet close. If you lose, you know where to come. If you win... His face knit hard. If you win... Ah, friend, see to it. See the signers escape not. Hold them to the last shekel. That is what they would with us.
Trust me, replied the purveyor.
Will you not sit with us? Asked Simonides.
You are very good, the other returned. But if I leave the consul, young Rome yonder will boil over.
Peace to you.
Peace to all.
At length, the recess came to an end. The trumpeters blew a call, at which the absentees rushed back to their places. At the same time, some attendants appeared in the arena, and, climbing upon the division wall, went to an entablature near the second goal at the west end, and placed upon it 7 wooden balls. Then, returning to the first goal, upon an entablature, there they set up 7 other pieces of wood, hewn to represent dolphins.
What shall they do with the balls and fishes, O Sheik? Asked Balthazar. Hast thou never attended a race?
Never before, and hardly know I why I am here.
Well, they are to keep the count. At the end of each round run, thou shalt see 1 ball and 1 fish taken down.
The preparations were now complete, and presently a trumpeter in gaudy uniform arose by the editor, ready to blow the signal of commencement promptly at his order. Straightway the stir of the people and the hum of their conversation died away. Every face nearby, and every face in the lessening perspective, turned to the east, as all eyes settled upon the gates of the 6 stalls which shut in the competitors. The usual flush upon his face gave proof that even Simonides had caught the universal excitement. Ilderim pulled his beard fast and furious.
"Look now for the Roman,"
said the fair Egyptian to Esther, who did not hear her, for, with close-drawn veil and beating heart, she sat watching for Ben-Hur. The structure containing the stalls, it should be observed, was in form of the segment of a circle, retired on the right so that its central point was projected forward, and midway the course, on the starting side of the first goal. Every stall, consequently, was equally distant from the starting line, or chalked rope above mentioned. The trumpet sounded short and sharp, whereupon the starters, 1 for each chariot, leaped down from behind the pillars of the goal, ready to give assistance if any of the 4s proved unmanageable. Again the trumpet blew, and simultaneously the gatekeepers threw the stalls open. First appeared the mounted attendants of the charioteers, 5 in all, Ben-Hur having rejected the service. The chalked line was lowered to let them pass, then raised again. They were beautifully mounted, yet scarcely observed as they rode forward. For all the time, the trampling of eager horses and the voices of drivers, scarcely less eager, were heard behind in the stalls, so that one might not look away an instant from the gaping doors. The chalked line up again. The gatekeepers called their men. Instantly the ushers on the balcony waved their hands and shouted with all their strength, "Down! Down!" As well have whistled to stay a storm. Forth from each stall, like missiles in a volley from so many great guns, rushed the 6 4s. And up the vast assemblage arose, electrified and irrepressible, and, leaping upon the benches, filled the circus and the air above it with yells and screams. This was the time for which they had so patiently waited. This, the moment of supreme interest, treasured up in talk and dreams since the proclamation of the games.
"He has come! There! Look!"
cried Iris, pointing to Messala.
"I see him,"
answered Esther, looking at Ben-Hur. The veil was withdrawn. For an instant the little Jewess was brave.
an idea of the joy there is in doing an heroic deed under the eyes of a multitude came to her, and she understood ever after how, at such times, the souls of men, in the frenzy of performance, laugh at death or forget it utterly. The competitors were now under view from nearly every part of the circus, yet the race was not begun. They had first to make the chalked line successfully. The line was stretched for the purpose of equalizing the start. If it were dashed upon, discomfiture of man and horses might be apprehended. On the other hand, to approach it timidly was to incur the hazard of being thrown behind in the beginning of the race. And that was certain forfeit of the great advantage always striven for, the position next the division wall on the inner line of the course. This trial, its perils and consequences, the spectators knew thoroughly. And if the opinion of old Nestor, uttered that time he handed the reins to his son, were true, it is not strength, but art obtained the prize, and to be swift is less than to be wise. All on the benches might well look for warning of the winner to be now given, justifying the interest with which they breathlessly watched for the result. The arena swam in a dazzle of light, yet each driver looked first thing for the rope, then for the coveted inner line. So, all six aiming at the same point and speeding furiously, a collision seemed inevitable. Nor that merely. What if the editor, at the last moment, dissatisfied with the start, should withhold the signal to drop the rope? Or if he should not give it in time? The crossing was about 250 feet in width. Quick the eye, steady the hand, unerring the judgment required. If now one look away, or his mind wander, or a rein slip, and what attraction in the ensemble of the thousands over the spreading balcony! Calculating upon the natural impulse to give one glance, just one, in sooth of curiosity or vanity, malice might be there with an artifice. While friendship and love, did they serve the same result, might be as deadly as malice. The divine last touch in perfecting the beautiful is animation. Can we accept the saying, then, these latter days, so tame in pastime and dull in sports, have scarcely anything to compare to the spectacle offered by the six contestants? Let the reader try to fancy it. Let him first look down upon the arena and see it glistening in its frame of dull gray granite walls. Let him then, in this perfect field, see the chariots, light of wheel, very graceful, and ornate as paint and burnishing can make them, Masalas rich with ivory and gold. Let him see the drivers, erect and statuesque, undisturbed by the motion of the cars, their limbs naked, and fresh and ruddy with the healthful polish of the baths, in their right hands goads, suggestive of torture dreadful to the thought, in their left hands held in careful separation and high, that they may not interfere with the view of the steeds, the reins passing taut from the fore ends of the carriage poles. Let him see the fours, chosen for beauty as well as speed. Let him see them in magnificent action, their masters not more conscious of the situation than all that is asked and hoped from them, their heads tossing, nostrils in play, now distent, now contracted, limbs too dainty for the sand which they touch but to spurn, limbs slender, yet with impact crushing as hammers, every muscle of the rounded bodies instinct with glorious life, swelling, diminishing, justifying the world in taking from them its ultimate measure of force. Finally, along with chariots, drivers, horses, let the reader see the accompanying shadows fly. And, with such distinctness as the picture comes, he may share the satisfaction and deeper pleasure of those to whom it was a thrilling fact, not a feeble fancy. Every age has its